Good evening. This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1204, we bring you two new stories by new Life Rattle writer, Sarah Middleton. Tonight's writer, Sarah Middleton, was born in Toronto in 1989 and raised in nearby Burlington, Ontario. She was very shy as a young person and found inspiration in playing the piano and reading novels. At age 15, life changed for Sarah when she learned to engage with the world rather than just observe it. At 17, she started traveling and lived in several different cities before returning home to Burlington. Sarah first attended college to study acting, but switched studies to pursue her love of English and writing. Sarah Middleton writes like an old soul for such a young writer. Her stories, often quiet and spare, allow the reader to draw their own conclusions. Tonight's first story is a tale of two tangled relationships set amidst the characters who frequent a neighborhood bar. Let's listen now to The Lucky Dice, written and read by Sarah Middleton. Please note, tonight's stories contain situations that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised.
The Lucky Dice by Sarah Middleton. I walk back to the bar and see Ed raise his empty beer bottle. I meet his tired eyes and nod in acknowledgement. I open the beer fridge and grab him another Canadian. Thanks, sweetie. Ed lives in one of the rooms above the restaurant. He is here every day and still doesn't remember my name. His unpaid tab runs to about $700 worth of beer and the occasional pie. I don't know why my boss, Steve, lets him run his tab so high. Ed's monthly disability check barely covers his rent. Outside, I see the sun has finally set. It's been a slow day at the Lucky Dice as my 11-hour shift comes to a close. Just Steve and I work tonight. He cooks, and I wait on the tables. I make a cursory round of the restaurant and check on the two occupied tables. I politely chat with the customers, ask if their food is fine, and fill their water glasses. I look around at the newly renovated space. Working here the past 6 months has been hectic. We've had to close different sections for painting, tiling, and sanding. The restaurant now looks new. The marble countertop of the bar adds a little class. I hear a ring and see Jerry walk in the door, whipping his long hair back. He's already tripping over his feet, and a dumb smile is plastered on his face. His lips suck in oddly because of his missing front teeth. When he sees me, Jerry's smile widens. "Hey, sweetie," he excitedly slurs. He sits across from me at the bar. "Beer and a shot, honey. What's your name again? Rachel?" "I've told you 3 times this week, Jerry," I reply as I grab a Budweiser and a shot of Southern Comfort. "Ha ha, well shit," he muses and slaps his knee. "Is it Rachel?" "Sure," I lie. Jerry sets his drinks in front of him. He grabs my hand and looks earnestly into my eyes. "Hun, do you realize how beautiful you are? Do you have a boyfriend, sweetie?" I look away awkwardly and see Steve's dark eyes dart away from me. His large frame leans casually against the counter in the open kitchen about 10 feet away. Steve suddenly appears interested in the traffic outside. "No," I pull my hand back. "Aw, well, that's too bad, a pretty girl like you. Don't you think so, Steve-o?" Steve looks up and his eyes flit to mine, then quickly away. He gives Jerry a half-smile. "Three shots," Jerry yells. "One for me, one for Steve, and one for you, pretty lady." I look to Steve for consent and pour 3 shots of Southern Comfort. Steve saunters over. We all say cheers and down our shots. Jerry tells Steve, "Hey, Steve, don't you think it's a shame that my sweetie here has no boyfriend? She's so pretty. Someone is going to want to snatch her up for a wife soon, eh?" Yeah, Steve mumbles. Usually not lost for words, Steve stays silent. He squeezes by me and makes himself a drink of vodka and 7-Up. He gulps it awkwardly and then sits beside Jerry. Steve turns the conversation elsewhere until Jerry asks, "Hey, Steve, how's the wife?" I quickly look at Steve, but he doesn't meet my eyes. "What wife, Jerry?" Steve asks in an offhanded way. "I'm single." Oh, you know, the pretty girl with the long dark hair and huge knockers that comes in here. She told me she was your wife. Jerry must be talking about Olivia. Nah, she's not my wife. I'm living the single life. Steve plays with the blue elastic band around his wrist. He doesn't look at me. I pretend to busy myself, unnecessarily filling the water jugs. I make the excuse of needing to check on my customers and walk away. I don't want to listen anymore. My tables are fine, so I decide to head downstairs to restock. The restaurant is in an old building, and the basement ceiling is so low I can barely stand upright. The heat is stifling and the lighting dim. The basement runs the length of the restaurant and is stocked to the ceiling with supplies. I head to the left where Steve has a small office. He keeps the red wine and vodka there, and we're running low. As I turn on the light, I remember the time Steve and I sneaked kisses down here during shifts. Steve and I dated in secret for a couple months. We both thought it would be better, not to mention that the owner was dating the waitress. We were going to wait until I returned to school to let the secret out. But our relationship ended 4 weeks ago when Steve found out his ex-girlfriend, Olivia, was pregnant with his child. The same night Steve found out about Olivia's pregnancy, we finally had sex for the first and only time. Every time I look at him now, I picture us rolling around in my bed together. It's hard to meet his eyes without cringing. We try to put on an act of normalcy, and it seems to work. No one has said anything. When I head back upstairs with the bottles of alcohol in my arms, I see Steve, Jerry, and Ed down another shot. My two tables are ready to leave, so I tally up their bill and cash them out. I pocket $8 in tip. Once they're gone, there's only the four of us left. Jerry buys me and the others a couple more shots while he rants about his ex-wife being a spiteful bitch. Steve decides to close up a bit early, and I go about my closing duties. Because of the alcohol in my veins, it takes me a bit longer than normal to sweep and finish restocking. Steve, Jerry, and Ed continue to drink. After about a half hour, Steve kicks them out of the restaurant with the excuse that he has to head to bed. The circles under his eyes have been getting steadily darker. Jerry and Ed drunkenly stumble from the restaurant, and Steve locks the door behind them. I turn off the backlights. Steve grabs the ashtray from behind the counter, and we both light up a cigarette at the bar. We're both a bit tipsy, and we make some halting conversation. Steve makes us a drink, mostly vodka, with a little 7-Up. We sit at the bar together and smoke and sip our drinks. I stare at the vases full of flowers that sit atop the bar, given to me and the other waitresses by male customers. Many of the flowers have been given by Jerry. After a minute of awkward silence, I turn to Steve and boldly ask, "So, how are things with you and Olivia?" "Things look good," he replies evasively, apparently absorbed in the straw he swirls in his drink. "What does that mean?" I inquire. He looks at me sideways and quietly responds, "I think she's going to have an abortion." "Oh." I'm a little stunned. I see him watch my face for a reaction, so I keep it blank and wait for him to go on. "Olivia decided she wants to go back to Africa to work for the UN. I don't want to be with her, but I'm not going to be a dick while she's carrying my child." He lets out a sigh and takes a drag of his smoke. "I'm going to play it cool with her, and I think she's going to decide to have an abortion on her own. She never wanted children." We sit in silence again. I finish my drink, put up my smoke, and stand up. "I should probably head out. I do have to be here again at 10 a.m. Steve nods, stretches, and stands up too. "I have to open tomorrow at 5, he laughs. Steve gives me a sly smile and opens his arm for a hug. I hug him and he buries his face in my hair. I've missed the feel of his big arms around me, but I pull away. When I do, Steve leans down for a kiss. I turn my head slightly and instead reach up and kiss him on the cheek. He smiles confidently at me, as if that was his intention. I don't meet his eyes as I softly say, "See you tomorrow, Steve." "Have a good night, sweetie." Steve turns around and grabs a cloth and wipes down the counter. I stumble over my feet as I walk out the front doors of the Lucky Dice and onto Lakeshore Boulevard. The sound of city traffic slams my ears. Across the street, Jackie gives me a somber wave. She's already working the corner. I wave back and sit down on a bench. I watch Steve in the glow of the window while I wait for a streetcar.
That was Sarah Middleton reading her story, The Lucky Dice. Tonight's second story is a powerful, moving account of a young German girl whose family opposes Hitler's reign in Gross-Justine, Germany, a small town that becomes a front line between the Russians and the Germans in the final showdown of the Second World War. Please note, this story contains situations that are intense and disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. Let's listen now as Sarah Middleton reads her story, Eva Wilkins.
Eva Wilkins by Sarah Middleton. This story is based on an interview with my grandmother, Eva Wilkins. She talks about her experiences in Germany during the Second World War. It's written from her perspective. I grew up in Gross-Justine in Pomerania, Germany. It was a small town with less than 1,000 people, but it was beautiful. We lived 2 kilometers from the Baltic Sea. Every day, me and my older brother, Johannes, would cut through the Hindenburg's property, over the meadows, and go swimming in the sea. The white sand stretched for miles. It was a good life. We never wanted for anything. Our bellies were always full. Gross-Justine had a school, 2 churches, 2 stores, a bakery, a drugstore, everything we needed. My family was well off, not in money, but in property. We had the biggest apple orchard for miles and miles. I remember taking a walk with Hindenburg's granddaughter one day, and she admitted to me that she and her sister would steal our apples when we had our backs turned. My mother, Mutti, always told us to keep an eye out. Paul von Hindenburg was the president of Germany for a time. He was in opposition to Hitler and a friend to my father until Hindenburg died in 1934. The name Hitler wasn't mentioned a lot. If it was, I didn't pay attention to it. I just assumed he was a good guy. I was young. One Christmas, when I was about 10, I thought it would be a good idea to give my papa a picture of Hitler. When papa opened my gift, he looked at me and calmly said, "Thank you." He beckoned for me to follow him. I followed papa into his bedroom. My father placed his finger over his lips. He opened the bottom drawer of his dresser and put the picture of Hitler face down in the drawer and covered it. Papa shook his head once and never again took the picture out. Not a word was said in case there were listening ears. Before the war started, my parents never told me to salute to Hitler, so I never raised my arm when everyone else saluted, until they made us. Germany went to war when I was 13. Not everyone in Gross-Justine opposed Hitler. My father's sister and her husband, the Wagners, were Nazis. Wagner was always jealous of my father because he had a bigger home and a better life. But that's just the way it was. When the draft began, my father was supposed to be safe because he was too old and he was sick. But Wagner and the mayor of our town, those Nazis, they were supposed to be drafted, but because of their connections, they were able to weasel their way out of it. They pointed their fingers at Papa instead. Wagner and the mayor remained safe, and my sick father was taken to fight a war he didn't believe in. In the years following, we were able to remain in our home, but there was no school or church. Our days were spent trying to stay safe. Our town eventually became the front lines between the Russians and the Germans. The Germans didn't realize civilians were still there. Every night we heard gunfire and cannons. There would be a bang and then light, and then a bang and then light, like fireworks. I remember the first time I heard real fireworks, years later in Hamburg. I was so startled. They sounded exactly like the explosions during the war. One night, my family was huddled in our damp basement on a sack of potatoes. The house shook every few minutes from the cannons and gunfire. We survived the night, and in the morning Mutti took us to the neighbor's house. She figured we would be safer in numbers. I remember walking across the meadow, and I felt a strong urge to put my back down. As I hit the ground, a bullet flew over my head. I could hear the whistling. I think God saved me that day. I don't know why. One day, when the fighting was bad, the Russians told us to leave and find a safe place. We were sent east, where the fighting used to be. We stayed with some soldiers. They fed us, and they were very nice. We went back and forth between there and home for a time. At home, many of the women and children in town moved into our house for safety. There were about 25 children and 10 women. We were all scared. 2 of my friends were poisoned by their grandmother because she felt death was better than this life. The soldiers liked to play games with us. One day the Russians told all the males, my brother Johannes included, to go to the marketplace. I didn't want him to go. He never returned home. Then, on March 6, 1945, the Russians came into our town. They told us to pack our things and leave. Grosseteste was now Russian territory. Many died that day. My Russian nanny begged for her life, but they raped and killed her in our home. The soldiers let me say goodbye to her dead body. We took only what we could carry, food and one blanket each. Our party consisted of me, my mother, my aunt, my little sister Ruth, and my little brother Ernie. We were headed west to my mother's old town where her parents still lived. We walked and walked and walked. It felt endless. We slept outside. We slept in a train station. We slept on grass. We slept on tables. We slept in a school. We slept on benches. We never complained, though. At the end of the day, we were too tired to care where we slept. Wherever we went, we had to beg for food. Many of the places that we passed through lay empty. All the homes had been abandoned. Sometimes we would find an apple tree, and we would eat the apples. It reminded me of home. We wouldn't have eaten them, though, if we thought it was stealing. We walked for a few weeks. One day a train passed us, and Muti told us to jump on. We were so exhausted, and the idea of not having to walk was wonderful. So we jumped on. We thought the train was headed west, but it took us south. We went many miles out of our way. After almost a month of walking, we made it to the border of the Russian and British zones in central Germany, no man's land. There were guards everywhere. Each night I could hear people being shot, by the Russians or British, I don't know. We waited for over a month trying to find a way to cross. Finally, we met a farmer who had property rights on no man's land who was allowed to cross freely. After many arrangements, he agreed to take us across, hidden in his hay wagon. He risked his life for my family. My mother was scared. If we were found, we would all be killed. So, I volunteered to go first. I went with my brother Ernie, who was 5 at the time. We hid in the back of the hay wagon. Halfway through no man's land, we transferred to another farmer's wagon who took us to the other side. There was no time to feel scared. When we made it across, I took Ernie's hand and we knocked on doors until we found a place to sleep. I didn't worry for my family. Worrying made you do nothing. I couldn't afford to do nothing. We found a place to stay, and in the morning the family made us breakfast, and then Ernie and I went to the border where the British were. And there was Muti, walking towards us, safe and unharmed. After a couple more weeks of walking, we made it to my grandparents' house. Our journey was finally over. When I knocked on the door, there was Johannes. I threw myself at him and hugged him as tightly as I could. We both thought the other was dead. Johannes told us he ran away. He made his own way across Germany and had arrived at our grandparents' house only a month before us. The war ended a couple months later. It wasn't until 1947 that we found out what happened to my father. We made contact with a German-speaking pastor in France who knew my father. Papa was put in an American-French prisoner of war camp in France. He eventually died of starvation. But those kind of things happened. He had to live through it. We never made it back to Grosseteste, to the sea and the white sands. We had everything we wanted there, at least for a short time.
That was Sarah Middleton reading her story, Eva Wilkins. That concludes Life Rattle number 1204. My name is Lori Callis. I recorded Sarah reading her stories. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman. Tune into Life Rattle next Sunday night at 9 to hear more stories.